Hello, this is Alberto Grignolo, Deputy Editor of DIA Global Forum, and I'm here at the 2015 DIA Annual Meeting in Washington with Elizabeth Garrett, who is Senior Director of Safety Risk Management at United Therapeutics Corporation. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Are the track chair for Clinical Safety and Pharmacovigilance, and I'd like to ask you, first of all, what are the key themes and messages that you are picking up from the sessions in this track for those listeners who are not able to be here or were not able to attend the track?
All right. Well, I think that the track is doing a really good job of capturing a lot of what is currently of interest or certainly current events that have very thought-provoking and long-range implications, that being the recent epidemic with Ebola. There have been really three, one within my tract, the tract for pharmacovigilance, and two other discussions that align very well. And basically what we're trying to do is look at that particular epidemic and see how best to handle some of the most challenging situations that the world faces with public health, one of those being pharmacovigilance, and certainly trying to understand more about the safety of the medications when they're being used early in development in patients to eradicate an epidemic. So we examined that in one of the sessions within the pharmacovigilance tract. Some of the other sessions were devoted towards what are the key features of the Ebola epidemic and how, as a public health threat, the challenges that other organizations, other stakeholders met to be able to address those. And then there was a very interesting one on data. What types of data are necessary to be able to look at the safety profile of the products that are being used very early in development to ensure some element of safety for these patients, largely in West Africa.
Did these sessions surface any useful lessons learned from the recent epidemic that might suggest different ways of handling safety should the epidemic recur or similar epidemics recur?
Yeah, I think we've examined both the challenges and certainly the readiness of these low-income countries to be able to handle their predicament. Quite often they're very ill-prepared. Internet's not there in large capacity. They don't have the knowledge and the understanding of being able to look at large amounts of safety, let alone collect it. So there's a lot of training. The World Health Organization, the Gates Foundation, a lot of very dedicated individuals are sponsoring lots of educational opportunities in those countries to try to bring them to a level that they are able to function on their own. Interestingly enough, they do have some ability to report adverse effects that have occurred with these products, albeit very, very limited. So what we're doing is trying to bolster that to allow them to be able to report the adverse effects so we can analyze it and keep our hands in the safety profile, because obviously patient safety is very important and we want to help them with this disease, but we certainly don't want to cause any further harm. So it's important that we work together as a global community to be able to come together to aid these victims in these countries.
What is the level of confidence in the reliability of the reporting of adverse effects in connection with this epidemic?
Well, I think the question is, we know that they're reporting very low numbers of adverse events. You can come away from that and say, well, are there just not any adverse events? But the intellect in me says, no, there are adverse events. So it's a training issue of going in there and educating the healthcare workers as to recognition of adverse effects. And then better than that, having that suspicion. Because once you have that suspicion between the drug that they're taking and the adverse effect, you can then say, is there some correlation? Am I seeing this particular adverse effect because of this particular therapy? The other complicating factor is we're going into low-income countries, countries that have traditional medicines that are being given concurrently with this new medicine that's coming from the West. And so what effect, if any, and we know that from many, many different studies that we've done here in the U.S., that when they're taking herbal medications, alternative therapies, natural therapies, that there is a concomitant mix, and you can have very, very bad effects from that. So bolstering their ability to tell us a good medical history, along with monitoring the safe application of the therapies within that particular area, is tantamount to being able to help these people. So,
knowing that the Ebola epidemic has largely abated, this, of course, is very good news for those affected in the Western African countries. But does it pose any challenge in terms of safety monitoring or even development of vaccines for Ebola should the epidemic recur?
Well, I do think that there's a, and that's a very good question. It's true that we do not have the numbers of patients with active Ebola to even test the therapies on. But the vaccine that are being developed, there's a huge interest in developing vaccines, and certainly a lot of the sponsors have come together in the global community with interest in developing these vaccines. So you do have a rich population of patients down there in which to vaccinate against the recurrent outbreak of future Ebola outbreaks. And you can certainly test for that and test the titers in their blood to make sure that they have adequate protection, and at the same time test the long-term safety to make sure that these vaccines are not creating other issues for these patients.
Who are the players in these efforts? What the institutions, entities, etc.?
Well, there's academia. There are there's even political pressures to make all this happen. There's foundations have given tremendous amounts of dollars to help with this effort, and sponsors. There has been a huge effort on the part of many, many different sponsors, and those are drug manufacturers, vaccine manufacturers, and diagnostics. And they have all come together with a global, I guess, aligned effort to go down to the West African countries and administer to this problem in a very concerted way. So I think there's a huge coordination. The NIH obviously is involved, so some of the global agencies that you might imagine. The regulators are involved because they're very, very interested, because a lot of the sponsors were being asked to contribute compounds very, very early in development, and they were seeking alternative, more accelerated pathways to get their products approved, or at least being emergency INDs, to be able to go down and administer products, and that includes vaccines as well. So I would say that it's a huge global effort right now.
Almost a finest hour, would you say?
I would say that it has been. In looking at all the information that has been made available to me, I am very proud to be able to have this discussion, because I think that what I'm seeing from a worldwide collaboration is really something that we should all be proud of.
Very inspiring.
Yes.
Let me move to another area that was covered in this annual meeting, in this track on clinical safety and pharmacovigilance, and that is, there was a session that asked the following question. Has the new format PSUR PBR achieved what was originally intended? How was this question answered in that session, if it was answered?
Well, I think this was a very, very good session. There was a lot of really good, I think, discussion around the opportunities, the challenges, the successful nature of which this very analytical report was developed in Europe for use over in Europe for reporting periodic reports. So I would say that, yes, I believe in the way that I look at it, yes, we have achieved some goals. Is it truly something that has evolved into a well-understood vehicle for communicating all of your safety issues with the products? Not really, because I think people interpret the sections a little bit different and they struggle. But I do think that there is a question and answers document that has been put out by the European agency that goes a long way to try to help folks that are trying to put together these large, huge documents of safety information in a way that answers some of their questions, because they were aware that this was a shift. What we've done is we have shifted from dumping large amounts of data to the regulators with little or no analysis to a document that is hugely analytical. It's not really required to give them all the raw data, if you will. You have to look at the raw data, and they want you, the sponsor, to interpret what you're seeing. So you are really in a different position than we've ever been before. And I do believe that this is a very, you have to have a lot of responsibility because you are communicating to the regulators how you look at your product. What is the benefit risk of your product? Are you experiencing more risk than you have been before? And they're asking you very fundamental questions. So I do believe that this particular report has achieved what it is intended to do. Can it get better? Of course. Are we looking at ways to be able to talk about benefit risk in a way that makes everybody a little bit more comfortable? Because we as pharmacovigilance experts can talk about risk all day. That's exactly what we look at every day. But how do we balance that in the context of benefit? And what is the right way to look at that? And what's the framework? What's the best framework? And there's many different people out in the world that have developed different frameworks that kind of an algorithmic approach towards balancing, figuring out what your ratio looks like. But I think there's some work to be done. I think there's some refinement, but largely I would say that the session examined some of the challenges that everybody out there that does PBRs would certainly contend with, and that is, you know, worldwide harmonization. If you're a sponsor of in a company and you're developing these PBRs, and it takes tremendous hours and resources to develop because it's very comprehensive. It's extremely cumulative, whereas the other more recent report was really not cumulative. It was more interval-based. The new report balances the interval against the cumulative. So in that way, you're really looking at emerging new risks in a very comprehensive way. The new report talks about emerging signals. You know, what have you seen? Are you seeing anything that you've had to document or you've had to change your label about? They look at the new info on risks and they really try to put it in context. Is it new? Is it related to the disease? Are you seeing lack of effect in certain circumstances? Is your patient population using the product off-label and why? So the other big challenge I would say is trying to get all the countries that require this report to harmonize so that the sponsors are not being asked to create the same report for different time periods. I think that's a huge challenge right now. Not everybody's on board, and so we need to, as a global community, harmonize better.
Should that harmonization follow perhaps the path traced a decade ago by the Common Technical Document, which at least in modules 2 through 5
right.
was reasonably standardized and numerically structured? Is there a need to take this report to that level of granularity to make it more user-friendly?
I think they initially conceived it to be that way. It's very modular in its nature. The PBR report is meant to be somewhat interrelatable with the DSUR report, the development safety report, as well as the risk management report. So it is really meant to be able to use certain sections, completely just lift it and put it in the other report. So you should be able to do that. Now, is that really something that's happening? Not everywhere. And so to your point about, you know, maybe making this a little bit more modular, more standardized in a way with the Common Technical Document, you know, again, there's probably people that would disagree with me, but I do think that we need to look at that a little bit in a better way, because I think standardization, harmonization, and pushing that on a global initiative is going to allow us to create only one document instead of multiple documents for different regions.
I want to ask you about social media. Obviously, you know, this is a heavily regulated industry when it comes to pharmacovigilance. Mm-hmm. So are there any opportunities that social media websites such as Facebook present to improve clinical safety and pharmacovigilance? Or are there challenges or impediments that they present for the effective conduct of pharmacovigilance? Where do people at this annual meeting opined? Where do they fall on this sort of continuum of opportunity versus challenge or impediment?
Well, I think social media is certainly something that is keenly being batted about, if you will, in the area of pharmacovigilance and also in the area of clinical trial development. I think that we've all been aware of some of the challenges with clinical trials and the fact that patients will go off and talk about their therapies on various social media sites and in some circumstances unblind the trial. That's a huge problem. You compare and contrast that with the wonderful disease communities in the post-marketing realm that certain companies are putting out there to allow patients to come together in a protected environment to talk about their disease, to talk about their therapies, to talk about the best practices, and share all of that in an open community. I do think that that's very powerful. I think sponsors have brought to bear a lot of technology advancement in that way. I think from a pharmacovigilance standpoint, we have to be, obviously we're a very regulated industry, we need to be very careful, and FDA has recently, as of last year, came out with a couple of new documents, guidances that address several aspects that are challenges for folks, and that is talking which media is the best media to use for certain discussions, because not all media, not all social media or digital communication is appropriate. Okay, so which one? You know, Twitter's very short. You know, you're limited by 120 characters. You go up to Facebook. Is that as interactive as you want to be? How interactive do you want to be? Do you want to be static? Do you want to push your data out? Or do you want to accept free text? And if you're going to accept free text, you have to be very careful because you have to surveil that free text and look for adverse effects that are being reported. And done in a controlled environment, I do believe that this is possible, and there are several pharma companies that are pioneers in this, and they're doing a good job. They really are. And we're learning. We're learning about the disease. We're learning about the challenges, the burden of the disease on the patient in a way that we never had that possibility before. And that's really helping us frame, I believe, the patient experience, because patients are sharing with us what they care about in a way that's very near and dear to them. And we need to listen to that and be mindful of what we're hearing, and then also design therapies that keep that in mind for patients. What is the big thing that patients want? What is it they're suffering from? What is the big adverse event that they hate? You know, what are the things, what is their tolerance, their risk tolerance in terms of adverse events? And so, particularly with some diseases, you know, the benefits of taking the drug far outweigh the risks, and there's a trade-off. And you can really learn a lot from these patients through this type of medium. But there are responsibilities that pharma has to pay attention to. I think we're getting much better at that, and I think that going forward, it's out there. Digital communication is just at its precipice, I think, of being, you know, a real global change for the way that we communicate. So I think everybody needs to pay attention to it, and pharma needs to wake up and realize, hey, okay, it's here. I can't ignore it. They want to hear about adverse experiences only through certain channels, and they need to realize the value, I think, of other channels as well.
Social media generate a lot of noise. Is there a danger that when it comes to self-reporting adverse mm-hmm. events, there will be a lot of noise because the social media do not have neat fields like databases
right.
where information can be neatly categorized? So is there going to be too much noise that will create potentially a lot of unnecessary and unproductive work sifting through masses of self-reported adverse events that patients are sending in but in an unstructured way? Does this have the risk of being not useful, but rather a waste of time?
Right, absolutely. And I think that's a very valid point. And I think a lot of the folks that have dealt and work in this space, particularly the entrepreneurs that are developing statistical and software packages that go out and scrape the internet looking for these bits and pieces of pertinent information, and pertinent is relative, because, as you said, are we just collecting noise? And what is the relative difference between collecting the noise and then collecting the information that really has an impact? I think there's a lot of good work that's going on out there right now. I agree with you. You know, the first step is to collect the information. Then you analyze the information. And then the pearls of wisdom of that information is probably a very small aspect of what you've been able to pull out of the internet. It is resource intensive. It does require, if you do it well, some type of a software that allows you to pull the data back and look at it in a controlled manner. But I do think the rewards are out there. There's several software packages. I'm not going to go into the names in this form, but I will say that you can go and look on the internet. There are case studies that are out there that show, to your question, the benefits, and also certainly speaks to the noise. You know, the false signals that you see out there. but they also were able to give case studies where they actually did find circumstances of interest that they investigated, and they certainly are, you know, continuing to investigate that today.
Thank you. Elizabeth Garrett is Senior Director of Safety Risk Management at United Therapeutics Corporation. Elizabeth, thank you very much for being with us today. For the IAEA Global Forum, this is Alberto Grignolo.